and welcome to the Trev and Ben podcast. How are you, Ben?
I'm not too bad. How are you?
Yeah, all right. We're still in tier two where I am. What's happening where you are?
I think I'm tier one.
Still in tier one. Oh, look at you.
Yeah, well.
Still able to socialise.
Well, I'm not, just in case, but yeah.
So it's been another weird old week. I must admit, I've not really done much. It's just been weird not being able to go out and do stuff again. It's like, oh, it's one step forward, two steps back at the moment.
Yeah, I've noticed that Wales seem to have lost the plot a little bit.
Yeah, Wales is in complete lockdown, isn't it?
I do feel sorry for the people of Wales. I noticed earlier on that they're now restricting things that you're allowed to buy in the shops.
Yes.
And even earlier on, I'm not sure if this was specific to Wales or not, but I think Tesco had to put out an apology because some lady tried to buy some sanitary products and was told they're not essential items.
Yeah.
I beg to differ.
And I think some people, I was watching a thing on the news earlier, and they went to a little sort of convenience store in Wales, and the guy was saying, you know, if somebody comes into my shop, he had sort of gloves and hats on sale. He was going, you know, if someone's cold, a hat would be an essential item to them. So, I mean, the whole idea was that it was so the supermarkets aren't selling stuff that other shops that have had to close sell. But they spoke to one woman who runs a birthday card shop, and she said, I mean, you know, lovely sentiment and all that, but all it's going to do is push people online anyway, so you might as well still sell them in the supermarkets.
Yes, and I dare say if you walk into a shop which has cordoned off the clothes aisles, if you walk into that shop stark bollock naked, they will soon change their mind that clothes are essential.
When a man went into, was it Tesco's or Sainsbury's, just his pants? Yeah, it's just a weird, like the year just gets weirder and weirder. One thing that happened this week that's quite sad, but I think we need to just mark the man because he was incredible. James Randi passed away this week.
Yes, age 92, and you introduced me to him. He was absolutely fantastic.
Now, people who don't know who James Randi is, he was essentially started life out as a magician and a very successful magician.
The Amazing Randi.
The Amazing Randi. But later in life, he spent his life debunking and demystifying and exposing people who were claiming to have certain powers, for example.
Yes.
He was famously part of the David Letterman show back in the 70s or 80s when they had Uri Geller on.
Mm.
And basically James Randi's got no time for Uri Geller.
We should point out as well, the way that English libel law works, if you say something along the lines of Uri Geller can't bend spoons, that is libelous.
Yes.
And it's up to you to prove he can't, not for him to prove he can.
That's it.
So James Randi came up with the brilliant solution of offering a $1 million, was it dollar or pound? I suppose it would be dollar, wouldn't
probably
it?
Probably dollars, yeah.
$1 million prize for anyone who could prove the paranormal under his controlled circumstances.
Yeah, yeah.
And how did Uri Geller get on?
Well, I mean, if you've not ever seen it, it's on YouTube, because they bring out all this stuff, keys and spoons and stuff, and they're not Uri Geller's spoons and keys. They're the ones that James Randi has brought to the studio for the evening.
But they were just simple metal spoons,
just
correct?
Everyday spoons. Yep. But the conditions for Uri Geller's powers weren't right that night.
And damn.
He wasn't able to perform his normal wonders with spoons.
And, what are the odds?
He just James Randi just spent his whole life doing stuff like that. And there's a great, I wish I could remember the name of the documentary, but there was a great documentary on a couple of years ago. I don't know if that was how I introduced you to him, with the documentary that kind of follows him in his latter years. And he came out as gay at about 90.
Yes, he did, yeah.
And married his partner and found happiness and all that. But he was just an incredible man. And it's kind of one of those things that you just thought he was going to live forever. Because I think you said it to me when we spoke on the phone, he always looked an old man.
Yes, I think he was probably born with that thick, white, bushy beard, and, and he always probably always looked about 90-something.
Yeah, incredible. So, very sad week in that sense, but just great to be able to celebrate the man. And if you've never seen any of his stuff, just search James Randi on YouTube and Google and find out about his stuff. Magicians Now kind of looked up to him, didn't they? Was it, did yes. Penn and Teller, were they like, was he like a hero of theirs?
I think he was a hero to so many in the sort of magician's circle.
Have you ever tried magic yourself, Ben?
I did. As a kid, I showed some vague interest in it, but when I suddenly realised the sort of hand dexterity and practice and hours of dedication, I quickly got bored of it and just enjoyed watching it instead.
Yeah, my brother had a magic set when he was younger. And there were some tricks that I could do. There was one I bought this thing that was like a magic wallet. And I love that. I knew how that worked. But yeah, all the rest, it was like way too much work involved in having to learn to do it. The best thing is when you've got little kids around, because you can get away with all kinds of shit. I remember once, one of the times I was Father Christmas, and at the end of the afternoon, there was this one kid left who was waiting to be picked up by mum or dad. So I couldn't get changed yet because I had to change in the main hallway of where we were. So I just had to sit there in the Santa outfit. So she obviously came over to me, this little girl. So I was thinking of ways of entertaining. So I thought I'd do the old coin trick where you make a coin disappear and then it appears from behind their ear.
Right, yes.
And I don't know how a normal magician would do that. But when you've got a sort of three-year-old in front of you, all you have to do is show the coin, put it in your hand, and then go to their ear and pull it out again. She was in fucking rapture. She thought I was the best thing since sliced bread. So, Ben, let's welcome to the podcast our guest. We haven't had a guest for a little while, have we?
No, not for a while.
But it's nice. We're very excited to have this person on today. It's a comedian, author, radio presenter, mental health campaigner. We're going to talk about all of that and much more. But I tell you what, Ben, he's one of the nicest people we've ever had the pleasure to meet as well, isn't he?
He is, and I really mean that. He seems to always be the chirpiest and loveliest of people. Deserve him, do we?
You don't deserve him. It's Dave Tudor.
That is such a lovely intro, but I now feel that I have to be nothing but happy and I can't say anything bad and I've always got to be like, basically like Tigger.
Yeah, that's what we're expecting.
You can't see it, but I'm bouncing around on my tail right now, so it's fine.
Excellent. I'll tell you what, Dave, I was thinking about the first time our paths crossed the other day, and the weird thing is, probably for about the first 3 or 4 months, we sort of knew each other. We didn't talk. Our relationship was literally a wave through a window.
Completely. And also, like, especially in that studio, I think, like, my relationship with that place was, I wasn't really an employee. I was just, like, the station pet. That used to go around and then just take for walks every now and then. So, yeah, I completely agree. It was, like, a weird sort of... And then when the time we actually introduced each other, like, we already kind of... We're very comfortable in each other's sort of company. Very odd.
Yeah, and because the thing is, we were both doing breakfast shows as well. We were in a building where there must have been 3 or 4 radio stations. And so at that time of the morning, you're not really in the mood. Or, I don't know about you, Dave, but you know, you do that whole thing where you open the microphone, you're like, hey, it's 6:05, hello. Whereas in Winnipeg, you're going, fucking hell, who's up at this time?
That's what I love about radio. Like, the worst one is things like, I don't want to name any radio stations, but they rhyme with Crapital FM. and you know that they've just come in and, oh, we've got to do this again. Hey, London, how are you? Yeah. And I just think that's so funny.
And there are those mornings where you turn up, you know, I mean, because we used to, that first building where we were all based in Battersea, like Ben and I, we'd get there really early, wouldn't we? Like, way too early, because we always shitting ourselves about being late. And we would sit in the car park in the car just having a little snooze before we sort of thought about going in.
Like Bert and Ernie.
Yeah, like Bert and Ernie. And, and the weird thing was, there was another radio station where there was a... like, the first person in was the newsreader, who was like... He was a lovely guy, but he turned up like he'd just come off of a hunt. And I'm sure he thought we were odd. Like, you know, we were just two of us sitting in the car park with our eyes closed in the car. And he'd always park right next to us. He had the whole fucking car park to choose from, but he parked right next to us.
It is weird how radio tends to attract those sort of people, because I got this weird job. There used to be this thing where basically it outsources traffic and travel for like BBC and commercial radio stations. Yeah. And I never forget, I got this job and I went to the studio for the first time and they said, oh, look, you can listen into this guy's bulletin. Do you want to listen to him doing that? And I was like, okay. And he was like, so the L25 is blocked up to Junction 7. That's up today. You're listening to Absolute Radio. My name is Bob Shinklein. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, now he's finished. I'm going to have a bit of a chat to him. I was like, oh, hi, mate. My name's Dave. And he went, oh, hi, Dave. Oh, yeah. And I was like, that's his voice. And radio just attracts these weird people.
But years ago, I was on holiday. I went to this terrible pub in West Wittering, right? And it was a sort of pub where you knew a fight would break out eventually. You were just sort of counting it down. And they had entertainment this night. I've told you this story before, haven't I, about Alan Shannon, Ben?
That's a bell, yeah.
So this guy turns up and he goes, hello, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alan Shannon, and let's start tonight's entertainment. And he's got a backing track, and he starts, well, hello, Mary Lou, or whatever the fucking song was, and then the CD jams. So then he sort of goes, oh, I'm sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen, let's start again. I'm Alan Shannon, let's get it going. And this happened about four times. By the fourth time, the audience are beginning to turn nasty. Like there's a woman in a wheelchair hurling abuse at him. And he's still going, I'm Alan Shannon, good night. Like, you'd be perfect on breakfast radio.
Oh, I love those. Funny enough, before all of these restrictions, at the start of the year, we went to a local pub near us, and it's exactly like that. It's a little bit stabby. And we were sitting there, and it was Saturday night, and they've got some entertainment. It was like 5 to 9. And all of a sudden, this really loud, like sound test came over, and these two people that were sitting near the stage got up and walked out. And the barman went like, "Hey, where are you going? Where are you going? This girl sounds exactly like Adele. Why are you going?" And they turned around and went, "We're going because that girl apparently sounds exactly like Adele. It's Saturday. I don't want that." And I was just like, "That's amazing."
So looking back to the radio, like, was radio something you'd always wanted to do? Was that your first job in radio?
Yeah, it was my first job in radio then. I've always loved radio. And ironically, I grew up with the Ugly Phil Breakfast Show on Kerrang Radio. And I later got to know the guy. And I just thought, I was like, oh, my God. I just always loved radio. It always sounded fun. I don't know if is that how you guys got into it when you were kids?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up, you know, that was all I wanted to do. And the weird thing is, like, I don't know how you feel about this, Dave, but I started hospital radio at 16. So Ben and I met doing hospital radio, but I've worked in radio for 25 years in one capacity or the other. But I always just wanted to do, like, I couldn't give a shit about the music. So like at hospital radio and community radio, when you do that, it's full of people who are obsessed by one sort of music or the other, or just think that they have to play you what they like, because if you haven't heard this, you're like some, like, you don't really exist. And for me, it was just like, how can I have some fun in the time between, like, the record just is basically there for when I run out of shit to say.
That's great. And when you're hungover, you know Bohemian Rhapsody's coming on.
Absolutely.
Ben, how did you get into it?
I joined Triv at hospital radio. And then from there, we moved on to community radio. And then when that shut down, we went to, to do our job on the London station.
Had you always wanted to be in radio?
Yeah, I've always loved radio. It's more of the, like, for the same reasons as Trev, I'm more interested in listening to people, what, you know, what they have to say. It's particularly if they're amusing. So I sort of loved the Ricky Gervais XFM show, Frank Skinner on Absolute Radio, but I can do without the music. But yeah, that's kind of the reason we got into it.
That's so interesting. Because I mean, I won't say which one, but I work for a talk radio. I just said it. But I work for a radio station that's based on speech now. And I'm always like, I'm actually the opposite. I'm there for the music. Like a lot of the time I've realized this, that people's views, that they find them so important to themselves, but for other people they're like, oh, okay, you think that, I don't think that at all. Like, politics is one of those, you know, splitting didactic things ever, and I just kind of wish that basically there was a radio station out there for chat that wasn't about politics.
Yeah, like, I love speech, but I can't listen to, like, phone-ins.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to hear someone going, Brexit! Brexit! You know, I just oh, shut up. I don't want to hear it.
So what? Wait, I'm confused, because both of you have said that you like speech radio, yet you don't like the music, but you don't want to talk about... What are you going to talk about?
I just want to hear people having fun. Do you know what I mean? I just want to hear people... like Ricky Talking Gervais bollocks, really. And Carl Pilkington just talking absolute shit. I mean, the thing I loved as a kid was listening to Chris Tarrant on Capital. He was like my hero. And him and Russ Kane and Howard Hughes just, like, I suppose, I hate the word, but the banter. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I completely agree with both of those statements, that I hate the term banter, but I also know exactly what you mean as well.
And the other thing about when you do the sort of music radio that certainly we were doing, when you're paid for it anyway, is you have no say in the music. So, no. And you get the boss sort of saying to you, sell the music. And really, you just want to say... Like when I worked at another radio station, and they put the owner, who was he was just horrible. He put his brother in charge, who had no interest in the station he was supposed to be running, and so I could get away with murder. And there was some song on the playlist by I can't even remember who it was. It was some X Factor winner or one of those, and it went on for about 5 minutes, and it was on every day on the show. And just one day I just stopped it halfway and I said, I can't play that anymore. It's just absolutely awful. And when I got to my next job, they're like, well, you could never do that. You could never do that here. Like, you know, you've got to say that you love every song. It's like, oh, really?
The other problem we had with the radio we worked for was that the equipment was so sellotaped together that it would fall off air so often that we just, I think one day we even resorted to singing, didn't we, Trevor?
Well, you were whistling when I was trying to get something working. Yeah. I mean, that's how desperate he became.
See, I think this is what kids don't get told, because when you are a kid, you're very impressionable. You think, yeah, these people sound like they're having fun. That's why I want to work in radio. But actually, one of the things that I've learned as I've got older and a lot uglier is, like, it's not the place. It is definitely the people that make it. And, like, that radio station that I used to do the breakfast show at, it was brilliant because nobody listened to it. So we could just, like, muck about. And I remember we once had to play a new song by Sigrid and just go, well, this is shit. Over the song, and we're like, this is great, you know. It's people that make things. Like, I never forget, my first job ever was in my first proper job was selling advertising space on a magazine. And it was just brilliant because they didn't measure you on, like, how much revenue you got or how hard you worked. It was just how long you would chat to people on the phone. So I had, like, a list of 6 or 7 clients that I'd go, like, look, it's a shit magazine. I know you're not going to advertise, but can you tell me about your dogs for 45 minutes? And they just would. It was brilliant.
And the thing is, like, when you're doing that sort of thing, so I used to make radio adverts. That was my job for 11 years at a radio station. And some of the products were just absolutely dire, right? And this was early on in the days of the radio station. There was this bloke who was a singer, and oh God, he was awful. And it was all on cassettes. It was all really hissy. And it was sort of like an opera thing. So it was all this hiss. And you'd be going, and just almost in the background, you hear him going, and he really wanted to support the radio station. So he kept coming back. And most salespeople, they don't care. Any money, it's commission based, just whatever. But I remember sitting down with a salesperson going, I can't make another advert for this. It's like 30 seconds of just, it's awful. And she phoned him up, and she was lovely, this set. Like, she was an exception to the rule. And she just sort of said, it's just, you know, let's not waste your money on this.
Oh, that's, I love bad adverts. Like, I remember when I was at the magazine, we had a problem client, and normally we would proof them, but we didn't because this guy was such a nightmare. So we ran with the advert, which we knew had wrong words in, which was simply, you've tried the best, now try the rest.
Oh, amazing.
I love stuff like that. What's the best worst job you've ever had, Ben?
Oh, God, that's tricky. I don't really know. What's the best worst job I've had? I think my current job, it's hard work, but I kind of enjoy it, I suppose.
Oh, that's doing what?
That's being a postie.
That's the postie thing.
Aww. You meet some very interesting characters.
Have you seen anyone naked yet?
Well, yes and no.
Yes and no. Well, that's a weird one. I mean,
he's seen them dressed up once, but then the next day he goes, not that. So
it's always usually men who open the door in their pants. I did get a woman opening the door completely in the buff the other day, but she was just out of the shower and she was sort of hiding behind the door. So yes, she was naked, but no, I didn't get an eyeful.
Did you sort of start saying, oh, do you need me to carry this parcel in? It's quite heavy.
I did consider peeking through the letterbox when she closed the door, but I thought that might be crossing a line.
You sound like a bit of a pervert going, I've got a big package for you. You're like, no. No, this is wrong.
Do you find, like, I don't know, I'm probably the oldest out of us three here, but as I've got old, I used to worry about what I look like if I was expecting a parcel. Do you know what I mean? I'd always sort of think, I can't open the door just in my tracksuit bottoms, T-shirt, hair all over the shop. I sort of always thought, if I'm expecting a parcel, I'd do myself up a little bit. But now, I've thought 43, I've take me as I am, mate.
I love the idea of you, just a little kid in a three-piece suit, coming to collect just a bunch of flowers. Yeah. How dressed up did you get?
Oh, yeah, I have like full, yeah, as you say, waistcoat. I'd have a little pocket watch just standing there. Like, you're a little bit late today, madam.
Yeah, this delivery for the 1400s. Yes, this is to you, Mr.
No, it was just like, I just always felt like, you know, like you have your indoor clothes. And I there was a time where I wouldn't open the door to a delivery. I'd always put my outside clothes on.
Is this because it's the Royal Mail? You think it sounds a bit more important than it really is?
No, it was just like, I don't, you know, I just basically don't want people to think I just slob around the house all day when that's what I do.
I think that's so commendable. I think in COVID we've got very much like that. The amount of Zoom calls that I've done where I've had a shirt on, but then tracky bottom trousers, or no trousers. I mean, it's great.
Yeah, I mean, I've barely worn socks for 7 months.
I mean, I was saying this the other day of like, actually, the idea of going to an office, like you've actually got to wake up in order to get the train to go somewhere. I'm like, I'm like pretty much sort of used to getting up with my girlfriend at like 9:03 when she's got to like, you know, roll into bed. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, your commute is down the stairs in my house. Like that's it. Oh,
I love that. I've got to admit, and especially for comedy gigs, I will absolutely not miss getting the last train from the arse end of Bumblechum. You know, it's like great to just do it out of the comfort of your own flat. Well, actually, they don't realise that you're doing cheese on toast at the same time as the gig.
Well, let's talk about your comedy then, Dave, because, I mean, this has been a hell of a... What a time to be a comedian. I mean, you must have had to find other ways of getting your stuff out there.
I have. Well, actually, something that I'm working on at the moment. So I do a lot of stuff about like mental health. And when I say mental health, I mean mental health, not mental illness. Because like, obviously, 1 in 4 people has mental illness, but 4 in 4 people have mental health. And I genuinely think that good mental health is like the best, most fun, exciting thing in the world. So what I've done is I'm working on a 6-week comedy course aimed at people with mental health difficulties, but in order to get them to associate good mental health rather than bad mental health and look at like recovery as something fun rather than something dull, which has just been so much fun to put together, because I'm using like loads of little games and stuff like that. It's been brilliant.
Wow. I mean, that sounds such an amazing idea, you know, because if somebody can just make you smile or giggle and you're having a shitty day, you're just, oh, that's a bit better, isn't it?
Oh, it's brilliant. That's why I think that actually mental health should be about comedy, and it should be about like acknowledging that. And like, even you just need to look at mainstream people, you know, Michael McIntyre's talking about like not being worrying about that he's not a good enough dad, or Lee Evans essentially being a freak, or Russell Brand always needing to get his end away. These are actually not really dark things that people are talking about, and I just think that it's a great conduit for like talking about loads of different unusual stuff. And I think like I've already been doing pilots with charities like the Mental Health Foundation and BEAT, which is the UK's eating disorder charity, and looking at doing one with Mind. And just some of the things, honestly, the thing is about comedy, people always think that if you do stand up, then you think you are better than other people. And actually, like, most comedians are more broken than anyone. I mean, it doesn't smack that you're mentally well if you want to stand up in a room full of strangers and try and make them love you, does it? You know what I mean? That's not a well-balanced person. And some of the things when I've been doing the courses that have come out are great. Like, so there's this little game that I did. There'd been this guy throughout the entire course that had been quite timid and quite shy and quite quiet. And there's this game that I do where basically you pick a topic and then you have to write down everything that you absolutely love about that topic. And then you spin it around and then you do everything that you hate about that topic. And the topic that I picked was Boris Johnson. And I was like, can you think about everything that you love about Boris Johnson? And people were trying to think really hard. And then I said, look, this is going to be, you know, someone sort of said one thing that they loved about Boris Johnson was that he'd been into hospital, he'd experienced COVID, but they were pleased that he'd come out the other end. And I said, can you think about something about Boris Johnson that you don't like? And this timid, quiet guy just went, that he recovered. That was the first thing that he'd said all course. And I was like, Jesus, that's dark. You know, everyone has their own little like way of humor. I think that's great.
I suppose it's that whole thing, isn't it? The tears of a clown and all that.
Well, there's this great phrase, like apparently Charlie Chaplin used to say that comedy is taking your pain and playing with it. And I think that's really a really lovely way of sort of seeing it, because like actually some of the best sets are about terrible jobs, like we've just talked about, like jobs that, you know, you and Ben sitting in the car park and fast asleep, that comes from a place that actually is pretty bleak, I do have to say it, guys. It's funny and you make that silly. So I think that's really interesting. I'm really interested to know what people would do their comedy about. So, okay, Trev, Ben, you've got to do a 5-minute set on one thing. It's either an anecdote, a topic, or something that you want to talk about. What would you do that on?
I'll let you go first, Trev.
Okay.
Just while I think.
Well, I think mine would be mine's fairly straightforward, I think, because I get angry quite quickly about I don't like noise. That would be the thing. It drives me insane, unnecessary noise. I've spoken about it so often on this podcast. People hooting their fucking car horns for no reason. That would be the thing. Like, what's wrong with it? Like, I've said this so many times, a car horn is there to announce emergencies and danger. It's not for hello. It's not for fuck off. That's certainly what I would talk about. I'd get that out off my chest.
Well, here's a little thing, Trev. I've got a theory that I think that instead of getting like points on your license,
yeah,
when you like break the law or something like that, if it's related to being like an angry driver, you have to actually pay to get your car horn changed. So like the more points on your license, the more stupid your car horn gets. So that like when you get like loads of points, it's like and then you just can't be an angry driver then if you've got a car horn like that. I think that's stands to reason.
Yeah, no, I certainly go along with that. You've got my vote.
I love that idea.
For me, it would be definitely, I mean, this might be a reflection on my character, but I seem to bump into some people in life who go sort of from 0 to 60 or to the furious scale with me. And wow. I don't understand why we've bypassed the sort of middle ground of pleasantries or whatever, and we've just gone straight to livid when it's so unnecessary. And I've started to just blankly stare at people in confusion as to why you felt that fury is the appropriate response to the smallest of infractions, and I just don't understand why people do that, and I've got no time for it.
This is the typical life of a postie. I think that's why.
A bad postie.
Have you got any specific, do people give you stuff? This is what I wanted to ask you. Do people give you stuff on your round, like chocolate bars or anything like that?
I have had some very kind people during some of the hotter days who've come out and give me a can of lemonade or something, which is very sweet. But that, you know, it has its double-edged sword, because I had one of my colleagues the other day, had someone approach them, cough, and then hand them a homemade COVID test kit.
But what she,
you do get given God, stuff
but
sometimes.
But what's she done in the run-up to that? That can't be the beginning of the story. That must be the end. Like, this posting must have been an absolute shit. Like, we've had stories over the last few weeks of Ben stepping on people's brand new lawn. Like, what's this guy done? Is he, like, shat through their letterbox or something?
It's just, not, I swear, 95% of the public you meet are fine. But it's those dangerous 5% you need to keep an eye on.
Something I did want to, you were talking about members of the public and places in public. I read an article the other day that said that it is a well-known trade secret that posties pee in public because you are working long shifts. There's nowhere to go to the toilet. Is that true?
Well, this is a strange boast, but I'm quite proud of my bladder. I can go all day without a pee. So I have never... Oh, no, that isn't true. I have. Yeah, I have peed outside. Yeah. No, I
what,
yeah.
During a round?
Yes.
Because over the last few weeks, your list of infractions has been mounting up. This must surely be the one that pushes you beyond the limits of being an employee of Her Majesty's Royal Mail.
Over the last few weeks, Trevor's been building a complete collection on ways to get me fired if he ever needs to.
Yeah, I mean, you might as well just piss on the Queen.
I will admit, I have had to relieve myself whilst on... route. Oh God, why am I admitting this? But I have done it in a very discreet, very no one can see, essentially.
And immediately after that, did a man cough and then give you a COVID kit? I think I can see where this is going from now.
But I mean, what about you, Dave? Because you know, being a comedian, your life must involves the public a lot. So, I mean, you must get some strange, not just heckles, but do people come up to you after gigs and stuff?
Well, this is the thing that is really, I hate to disillusion people, but I remember when I started watching comedy and you see people like Peter Kay, or you hear sets like by Russell Howard or Rob Beckett, and they're like, oh, this crazy thing happened on the way to the gig. And I always used to, perhaps call me naive, I always used to think that they were being honest and truthful. And I was like, oh my God, the life of a comedian is so exciting and so fun. People are just wandering around and they're constantly saying crazy things, but it's all a lie. They've told that at so many other gigs, and they've actually, what's worse is that actually now, if I'm in the back of a taxi or something like that, then people sort of say, what do you do for a living? I just lie, because as soon as you say you do comedy, people either go one or two ways. So go on, make me laugh, or they will say something like, okay, so a Jew, an Arab, and a Frenchman, and you're like, I don't want to hear the rest of that. I'm fine. I don't want to know. So I actually just lie, and the fun for me is just creating the most fantastical lie of like, I'm a bone doctor, but I will only do in like the actual hammer and stirrup inside the ear. I'm a very specific doctor. There's only three of us in the country, and we can never be in the same room at any one time.
Doesn't that have massive potential to backfire? Like, oh, thank God, you're just the man I need to speak to. My mother has a very specific bone disorder and I need your advice.
That's why I'll never say I'm the only one in the country, because I'm thinking of picturing my two other mates.
This was exactly what I was going to ask you, was that, you know, I mean, I like going back to wanting to be on the radio to make people laugh, I think it's always because I suppose there's a bit of me that would have loved to have been a stand-up, but the thing about radio is you're hidden. Do you know what I mean? The idea of going up on stage and have people looking at you wasn't for me, but also writing stuff. So it's bad enough on the radio when you're desperately trying to come up with some content for a show, and a bit like with a comedian, you sort of think, how does all this crazy shit happen to you, whereas all I've got to talk about is wearing my pants when the postman comes.
I think that's one of the things that is lovely about being a comic, is that I think you're just given more opportunity to look for silly things, and actually you will have more anecdotes than you, I, or anyone could ever imagine. It's just that you kind of like focus towards that more. But I think one of the flip side of things of like when you tell mates or they know that you do comedy, the lovely thing is that they start telling you all of this funny stuff that happened to them. And I think that's great. And I think that's the joy of the kind of live performance of things. Like someone told me a great little thing the other day that they said that they'd seen a meme, which I thought was brilliant. And it was, I just went to my first Zoom funeral and it was sad, but not as sad as my first Zoom comedy performance. And I was like, yeah, they are online. It's terrible.
Have you done some Zoom online gigs now?
I have, and it's always just, I think the weirdest thing is that people always say that there's not that call response thing from the audience, but I'm in a very lucky position that like at most of my shows the audience never really tended to laugh anywhere. So I think I'm kind of very, especially last Edinburgh, oh god, it was the worst. I didn't want to be there and it was my show. So I mean, last year I honestly had, it was terrible. The show was called The Pursuit of Happiness. And it was genuinely so bad. This is true. I realise this is a tangent, but this is honestly true. It was the second weekend of the Edinburgh Fringe. And one of my like door girls came up to me and said, like, look, we've actually got a member of the press. They say they're here from the broadsheets. They're here to review you. Now, what a lot of people might not realize is that's unusual because on a Saturday, most reviewers won't review. It's normally like your Monday through to Thursday. It's just like an unwritten thing because it's harder to get audiences in. They don't want to take up a seat that might be from a paying customer. So I was instantly surprised, but I think this is, if anyone's listening and wants to do comedy, this is how you win at comedy. I accidentally found out. I invited the reviewer in, who apparently was from The Guardian. I sat her down in the room and said, I'm going to be honest with you. This is a terrible show. You're not going to have a good time. I'm going to have a much worse time. And we're only going to ultimately waste each other's time. I'll buy you a drink if you don't come to the show. And she thought it was reverse psychology, so sat there through the entire shit show and luckily didn't print a review. But honestly, it was terrible. It was an awful show.
When you come to write a show, this is the thing that I could never do, and I admire you guys for being able to do it, is I can't get my head to write stuff. You know, if I have to sit down and some of my work, I have to write scripts, and they're pretty short scripts, but I find them agony to write.
I think one of the things that really gets me that people don't realize is that actually comics are some of the worst writers in pretty much most industries. But I think you can either use that or work against that. And like, in order to use that, something that I've come up with, like, you know, I'm sort of using in the comedy course, is stream of conscious writing. Because actually a lot of the time writing isn't sitting down behind the laptop thinking, right, I'm going to be funny. So one of the ways that I tend to write is walking around my room. I will have a set topic and I will just talk to myself about that topic and think of if I'm talking to someone else, if I was in the pub and I said, right, okay, we're going to talk about the life of being a posy. What is funny about that? Well, pissing in public, that's quite funny. The COVID thing, that's quite funny. But what is it? So I think that actually a lot of the time the term writing is quite misleading, because I think a lot of people either A, write on stage in the moment, or do that kind of stream of consciousness, like talking to yourself. And some of the best things that I've come up with, I don't feel arrogant saying, oh, they're good, because like it has almost been almost like I haven't really been thinking about it. Like, for example, a joke that I quite like that I came up with was, I was, you know, I had anorexia and I did the show about being anorexic. And I was like, anorexia is a huge problem. It's affected Kelly Clarkson, Lily Allen, Victoria Beckham. You know, it's responsible for a lot of rubbish music. And I was like, where did that come from? But like, it was just that kind of connection that like, so yeah, it's the term writing is very misleading.
And how important do you feel it is to be honest with your comedy? You talked earlier on about how, you know, when people say things have just happened to them in the street, they often and probably haven't. you know, getting on stage and saying, oh, my girlfriend split up with me this morning. And how often might you take a great anecdote your friends told you and adapt it so that it sounds like it's happened to you?
Oh, I lie all the time. I've never even had an eating disorder. I just did it for the Instagram. You know what I mean? I think it is really important to try and be... I really struggle with this because I want to be 100% completely truthful. But that terrible show that I was telling you about, one of the reasons that it was terrible is because, like, actually life 90% of the time is quite dull. And people aren't sitting there listening to, like, what order you wash the washing up in, or, you know, what shampoo you use. They're there for a laugh. So I find it really difficult to tread that line of trying to be honest, trying to be authentic, trying to be true to yourself. But then equally, you've got to get... I mean, the gold standard that you want for a comedy set is 6 laughs a minute. So about every 10 seconds, you want to get people laughing. And that is quite a demand.
Yeah. I wonder if giving your background on the radio, it's kind of an advantage, because often if you're talking on the radio and you're trying to be funny, you get absolutely zero feedback. You don't get to hear the laughter. And I wonder if that sort of helps you in what you do, or gives you the courage to get on stage in the first place.
Yeah, definitely. I think I always think with links and stuff that, you know, when you hear other people sort of doing little bits in between songs, you're like, you could halve that, you know. And I think I go too much the other way. I think that people actually have a bigger, like, attention span that I give them credit for. But the problem is, in my head, I'm only like a 6-year-old kid, and I just get distracted by, like, a squirrel or a smelly fart, and I'll just stop focusing a lot of the time. So I try and keep things a lot shorter than they actually should be.
Yeah, that's not really a problem that Trev and I ever had. I seem to remember at hospital radio, we did a 27-minute link on, what was it, ink cartridges?
Printer cartridges, yeah. Yeah.
A link so boring that even the CD corrupted, and no one will ever hear that.
Yeah. But this was the thing on the radio. Like, we used to have to, as I'm sure you did, you have your A boss or a couple of people sit down, they listen back to a show. And we went through a stage of having these with quite a well-known radio person. And, you know, you kind of revere this person. I'm not going to say who it is because it wouldn't be fair, but you kind of revere this person because they've been someone who you've known on the radio your whole life. And they would spend the whole time basically saying, yeah, I mean, it was good, but you could have done that quicker. And it was like, oh, okay. And in the end, it was like, basically, if it was more than 90 seconds, then we knew, I'd be sitting there watching the clock going, well, this is too long now. Like, we know what's going to come here.
You see, but I think that's exactly the same with comedy. This is what I was saying earlier on, is like, the way that you build the world in your mind is very different how it turns out. Because I remember when I first got with my girlfriend and sort of say, oh, you know, I'm a comic show. Oh, all these people, they must be so happy. They must be so full of joy. And you just get into a sort of a backstage green room, and there's just like loads of sort of 50-something-year-old blokes, women sitting there going, yeah, well, she's divorcing me. She's got... And you're just like, Jesus. And they're actually the most depressing people in the world.
Well, the thing about your comedy, though, Dave, is you were saying there is a lot of honesty that comes out. And you mentioned the anorexia, because that's formed the basis of at least one of your shows, and you're quite honest about what you went through.
Yeah, I think it's important. Like, the way that I always see it is, like, I didn't really choose to have a mental illness, so I'm not really going to apologize for it. But I think I did choose to sort of engage with treatment and try and get better. And actually, the thing that really frustrates me about the way that we bang on about mental health is that it's always really, it's just depressing. You know what I mean? And like, people don't need another reason to be depressed, especially if it might be depression that they're seeing in the first place, you know, the reason they're engaging with this. And how many times have you've seen on fag packets, you know, things like smoking kills, smoking causes cancer. I've never once seen someone pick up a packet of fags and go, oh, Jesus, smoking's bad for you.
And like, they've made them even more and more graphic over the years, and people are still kind of going, oh, well.
There's a great little joke by that, by a wonderful old-time performer called Andy Zapp, and he said he once bought a packet of fags and it said, smoking gives you testicular cancer. And he goes, no, I won't have those. I just want the ones that give you lung cancer. Brilliant. So I think that people learn by having a laugh. They learn by having fun, and they're led by positivity. So like, although, yeah, mental illness in and of itself isn't funny, there's loads of funny, silly little things that happen. And like a story that I always tell that I just think is the most, you know, sort of pressing when it comes to mind is that, you know, when I started developing an eating disorder, I didn't really know what was going on. I didn't really know what eating disorders were. And anytime I'd eaten anything, I'd run upstairs and I'd be constantly exercising. So I'd be doing push-ups, sit-ups and squats. And when I was writing the show about the anorexia, I said to my mom, did you never think to say anything to me about the, you know, about the exercising? And my mom sort of said, well, Dave, you're a teenage boy, and when your teenage son keeps on going up to his room and you can just hear rhythmical banging followed by repeated grunting, you know, you tend not to ask questions. I find it brilliant.
Was comedy came before radio in your life, right?
It was kind of at the same time. So when I was at university, I did this terrible radio show that had, it had more listeners in the studio than it did out of the studio.
Yeah, we've been there.
And I the thing that I really enjoyed is I did it with an idiot mate of mine who I had real enjoyment in pretending that I hated him. And I just really enjoyed that there was no nicey, like, hey, how are you this morning? It's like, oh, you idiot. Like, why are you wearing that? And so that was really good fun. But then at the same time, at like concurrently, as the posh people say, it's a big word, isn't it?
Yeah.
I started getting involved in going to see live comedy. And it was like £3 a pop. And we got to see people like Stuart Francis, Chris Addison, Russell Howard, John Robbins. And it was absolutely brilliant. And I do think if anyone has never been to a live comedy club, they are really struggling at the moment. Have a go. The most that you're going to pay is going to be 10-15 quid, which is pricey, but honestly, if you go to a good one, it's 100% worth.
So growing up with you, because like for me, like going back to the music thing, like some people, music is their thing, you know, when they're going through their mm-hmm. teenage years, it's music that matches the moments and the angst and all of that. For me, I didn't have that. It was always something that was a comedy that kind of
yes.
always alongside me sort of thing. And that's still the same today. And like those moments where you realise what comedy is really about. So one of my earliest memories was the Spitting Image thing. And I was way too young to get all the political stuff. But they just had it was a boxing match, Tyson and Bruno probably. And for no reason in the middle of it, they just had Cilla Black come into the ring and go, surprise, surprise! And that was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And I rewound it and watched it over and over again. And that was a moment in my life where I just thought, it can't get any better than that. Laughing so much.
See, but that's what I mean about the connection of comedy. I remember when I was at school and Little Britain came out.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the first season and no one had ever really seen anything like it. And the enjoyment for me was watching it. Yes, having a laugh. But I loved going to school with mates and going, do you remember this bit? Do you remember that bit? And then just repeating it ad nauseum. Like yeah. There's one that I absolutely love in the first series of Little Britain. There's a driving instructor and he's just sitting there in the car and he's going to his like it's the kid that his teacher's like, go faster, go faster, go faster, stop. And then he gets out of the car, puts on a policeman jacket and goes, you were doing a 70 and a 30, and it's just so stupid. I love that.
Yeah, and those moments, you know, Ben and I, we share a common thing, the first Bottom Live.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's just stunning. And I must have been, I don't know, 13, 14. And honestly, I knew it word by word. I watched it probably every single day. It was just the best thing I'd ever seen.
Well, I suppose my one like that is Mrs. Doubtfire.
Okay.
I can quote it back to front, inside out. I can do the voices, but I do remember it was the August the 11th, it was 2013, and I just finished a show, and then someone sort of saying, oh God, Robin Williams has just taken his own life. And I was like, oh my God. And it was just so like impactful. And that added a whole new layer to the whole kind of comedy thing. And I actually later found out that Robin Williams has this beautiful quote that I absolutely love. Was it? It's something along the lines of, I think some of the people have been to the darkest places want other people to see light because they know what it's like to be truly worthless and they never want anyone else to feel like that. And I was like, oh, and that's kind of, I suppose, the standard bearer of stuff that I want to do now is like realize that things can be rubbish, but comedy is such a great way of motivating people.
Yeah. Charlie Chaplin said, a day without laughs is a day wasted. And I just think, yeah, that's true, isn't it? If you have a day where you don't laugh at all, I swear I'll go to bed worse off.
I the thing that's really getting me at the moment is I love stupid, like you were saying about Cilla Black, my favourite types of laughs are the ones that are just embarrassing because they are so stupid. Like a great example is the other day we'd seen someone have posted this on social media. There was a someone was selling a bike on Amazon and they put £100 or nearest offer, and someone who was trying to buy the bike got in touch and said, how low will you go? And the seller took time out of his day to respond, about 2 miles an hour, otherwise you'll pop over. And I was like, that is brilliant.
Yeah, I definitely think that that particular bit in Bottom in the live show where it's all going wrong, that's a guaranteed laugh for me every single time. It never seems to get old, especially Rick Mayall sitting on the floor, dejected, it's all gone wrong, and he just says, come on, we're never going to get out of South fucking Hampton. Always gets a laugh out of me. And it's quite interesting that you've mentioned Mrs. Doubtfire. There is a. I wonder if you can finish the line for me, because you claim to know it word for word. He hits Piers Brosnan's character with some fruit by the swimming pool. He throws it at him. And this next line always makes me laugh. I wonder if you can tell me what it is.
She stands up and goes, oh, sir, I'm so sorry. Sorry, I was an angry member of the kitchen staff. It was run by fruiting.
Yes.
And the thing that I love is that he sits down and he goes, bastard. It's so funny.
Just the silly play on words of a drive-by fruiting. I loved it.
There's so many things in that. There's a bit in the scene I didn't even get until, like, I was far too old, but, like, he drops his false teeth out. His dentures go in the wine glass, and he goes, carpe dentum, seize the teeth. So many just flyaway lines.
That's the beauty of those sort of comedies as well, like comedies that are family movies and stuff, is you can watch them over and over again and find something new or different that's meant for the adult. I mean, that's why this, you know, I don't watch The Simpsons anymore. I kind of feel it's had its time, but The Simpsons was great like that.
Oh, I actually disagree. We've been watching on Disney Plus the newest versions. I think they've got better.
Have they?
If anything. Yeah, oh, mate, I think they're great. And they've become like, you know, they do stuff about like Tinder or Facebook or... It's been really good, but I completely take your point of like the thing that I love about comedy is it's so pure. You're never going to get fat from laughing too much. You're never going to, you know what I mean? Like you appreciate it purely for itself, for that little moment where you giggle. You're never going to, you know, be a millionaire from just laughing and hoping that someone pays you to laugh. It's just such a pure little thing.
And I think, like, because someone like Robin Williams, who was just, like, again, he was one of my heroes. I mean, I grew up watching the repeats of Mork and Mindy. They used to be on Channel 4, like, on a Wednesday evening at 6:30 or something. I wanted to be Mork, really, but I suppose I wanted to be Robin Williams. So much so that at a Cub Jumble sale, I bought, there were some trousers just like Mork wore, and I bought some braces so that I could look like Mork, you know? It was like, I wanted to be him so much. And then, obviously, like, watched loads of his stuff, and then came Aladdin, which was just...
Oh.
Like, I haven't watched the newer one, but don't remake that. You can't beat Robin. Will Smith Smith is amazing, don't get me wrong, but you can't beat Robin Williams' performance of the genie.
Oh, and so many lines in that were ad-libbed.
Yeah,
that were,
yeah.
Strangely, Robin Williams actually really fell out with Disney about that because he only agreed to do Aladdin on the basis that the genie wasn't going to be used for like marketing purposes. It wasn't going to be a thing. And he just used to go in the studio and have a little bit of fun. And he created so many of the lines. But because he was so good, then it was later used to be, you know, sort of marketing materials and stuff, which is the last thing that he'd ever wanted. But there's so many just brilliant lines of that. There's also a great one that always people miss out in the middle of Prince Ali, fabulous. And there's a bit where like he's on an elephant and the genie just goes, "Oh, I thought the ground was only meant to shake after the wedding." And it's just a brilliant little adult joke that he snuck in there. He was a brilliant man.
I went through a stage with Aladdin where I could pretty much, I knew all the songs, you know, and all the little ad-libs. I think it's in that Prince Ali one where he does like the football thing of love the feathers, you know.
If you had to be a Disney character, like out of all of the Disney sort of canon, including Pixar, who would you be?
Oh, that's a question, isn't it? I think it would probably be the genie.
See, that's the thing. I think everyone wants to be the genie. And that's so rare that it is like one character, you know, like out of all of them. But the genie was just the best character by far. He nailed that.
I think a close second would be Baloo the bear. I mean, he's fucking incredible.
Really?
I love Baloo. Yeah.
I'm imagining myself as, are you familiar with The Lion King?
Yes.
Now, do you remember Timon, the sort of meerkat thing?
Yeah.
That sort of hapless, useless, slightly overconfident thing. Yeah, that would be me.
Oh, that's great.
Okay, what about yourself?
I think I would go for a really weird one. One of my favourite Disney movies is Hercules.
Never seen Hercules.
You've never seen Hercules?
Never seen Hercules.
Oh, God. I love Hercules, and there's two little like demons in it called, I think they're called Pleasure and Pain. They're actually like from the sort of Greek thing, and they just have some brilliant little lines. They're just fun little characters, so I think I'd like to be them.
Isn't it amazing? I think Disney films, right the way back from whenever they started, like they're just, well, probably not the really early ones, like all the sort of, mind you, even like the Snow White and stuff, there's bits of comedy in there, isn't there? You know, I mean, the Seven Dwarves are comedy figures. But, I mean, they've always just consistently provided, whatever age you are, moments of enjoyment.
Yes, they do. But there's also, I challenge you to name me a Disney film that doesn't have something really harrowing happen in it.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, completely.
But that's part of the storytelling, isn't it? You've got to have, for the happy ending, you've got to have some shit kicking off somewhere.
Yeah, but for kids, I mean, some of this stuff is soul-destroying.
You've got to learn early, mate. Bambi, kill his mum off quick.
Yeah, Bambi's mum, she was offed.
Yeah.
Mufasa, he died. Buzz Lightyear learned he couldn't really fly. It was heartbreaking.
I would argue that Buzz Lightyear finally couldn't really fly is not as traumatic as losing your mother.
Not for Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah, it's like Buzz Lightyear's got like gluten intolerance or something.
Yeah, he's like a modern day Disney hero. Like the old fashioned shit would kick off, like parents being knocked off. The modern day is like, oh, I can't have some bread.
It wasn't so much that he realised he couldn't simply fly. It was the fact that he realised
the devastation.
Unique. He was a mere toy, a plaything. Nothing
to
more.
To agree with Ben though, one of the most harrowing starts to I think any film is like, I know it's Pixar, so it's like, but Up.
The first five minutes,
you're just like, what is this? Like, I honestly think that should be played with the Samaritan's number just along the. Just what is going on? Is this a family film or not?
Mind you, like when I think back to one of my very first cinema visits was to go and see E.T. I mean, that was a harrowing movie to sit through at 7 or 8 years old. I mean, the bit in the middle where you think he's going to die. Jesus Christ, don't put me through that.
It's like Dumbo as well. I got taken out of the cinema because like, I watched Dumbo. I was like, why do they? Apparently this is, I don't know if it's true of Walt Disney, but like Roald Dahl, like obviously his stories are like quite harrowing and apparently that's because he just hated kids.
Dumbo, Dumbo's mum with her trunk coming through the sort of bars of her cage, rocking her baby to sleep.
Yeah.
That always makes my wife cry without fail.
But isn't there
I'm welling up thinking about it now.
Isn't there the bit like where she kicks off and isn't she taken away because she goes probably like mad?
There's one called like The Fox and the Hound.
Yes,
I like had a mate over and we watched that. We were probably like 13-14, but I had to stop it because my mum had to give my mate a hug because he was just too, he was like beside himself of like crying, and I was like, god, they are just harrowing films. I mean, once you've seen that scene in Bambi, watching Saw is nothing.
But I suppose that's the thing, right? Because you've got to like those moments in film. So I remember my cousin, who's much younger than I am, a few Christmases ago, she said, I can't even remember the name of the film, but it was a film she'd watched as a kid. And she obviously remembered the feeling. That's the thing. You remember the feeling, not necessarily the story. And when she watched the film sort of as an adult, when we bought it for Christmas, she was like, oh, it's not quite as good as I remember. But that impact that it has on you as a kid. And the thing about the Disney films is they hit you as an adult as well.
Oh, hugely. I mean, they've cornered that market. And like, this is what gets me. Anyone that really, I mean, they you're absolutely right that you remember how you feel, not what you've seen, which is why Disney are just cashing in on everything, because like, you know, the people that are buying Toy Story toys, they're not 5 or 6 year olds, they're like 23-year-old blokes. They're like, I wanted a Woody and I couldn't get one that Christmas.
Yeah. Did what's the first
wanting
film
a Woody and not being able to get one can be a problem.
Yeah. Well, this is another, I mean, the name of the film is Toy Story and the two main characters called Woody and Buzz. Yeah. I mean, it is written like a dirty joke.
What's the first film that really made you angry? Because that's just something that's come to me, right? So talk about those emotions. So you get the kind of fear, dread, terror of the Disney films, but they really made you angry. Because first time, do you know the film The Hand That Rocked the Cradle?
I've heard of it. Yeah.
So it's like one of those films where someone is wrongly accused of some, I mean, it's a horrible thing, killing a child, or, I mean, it's just horrendous. And he's being framed. And I must have watched that when I was about 14. And I couldn't, like, the rage I felt. It was like the first time a film had evoked such rage within me. How could this injustice be allowed?
You see, this paints you out to be such a better person than me, because my answer for that was, I remember when I was a teenager, I went to the cinema to pay to see, it was a Will Ferrell film called Talladega Nights or Talladega.
Is that the racing car one?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's something to do with and it just made me angry because I was like, I've paid £9 to see this and it's shit. And it just made me really angry.
Ironically, my mum regularly takes the piss out of me for this. This is an Adam Sandler film called Waterboy. Are you familiar?
Yes.
I don't think I've seen it.
Okay, well, there's a bit in it where he gets relentlessly teased for making a fool of himself. And I got very angry that everyone was picking on him. And I was watching this as quite a young boy. And I got very blubbery and upset, thinking someone should step in and defend him at this point.
Good on you.
And rather than comfort me, that her crying son was feeling sorry for this character in the film, my mum has not let me forget it to this day and still takes the piss out of me for crying at an Adam Sandler film.
I feel your pain. I loved Waterboy, but yeah, it's so mean. They're said bullies are horrible.
Yes, yeah. but those films that make you cry that sort of shouldn't make you cry. We've all got those. Yeah. So that's obviously yours, Ben.
Lord of the Rings was like for me when that finished. I mean, the problem was the Lord
was
of the Rings.
Was it tears
like,
of joy that it finally ended?
Ben's not a fan.
Well, there are actually tears because I've been awake for 27 hours solid, because that's how long each one is. It just went on and on and on. And like the thing that annoyed me about the last one was that it finished about 7 times. You're like, oh, this is the ending. Oh, no. Oh, here's another one. Yes.
Oh, they did that with, I mean, I love Star Wars, and my godson is massively into Star Wars. So we, every time the new ones come out, we've taken him along. I haven't seen the very last one yet, but the last one I took him to, it was the same thing. Like, I'm of an age now as well where my ass goes to sleep very quickly. If a film's more than an hour and a half, I get fidgety. Yeah. So we're watching this film, and same thing, you think, oh, the camera's panning back, it's a mountaintop shot, surely that's the end. No, another fucking scene. Then we get another pan back mountaintop scene. You think, well, that must be it. Rousing music. That's, oh, I'm beginning to get up now. Oh, no, we're back in a fucking cave again or something. You're like, just finish the fucking film.
I think if you get the DVDs of that film as well, there's like hours and hours worth of deleted scenes and stuff. And it was even longer originally.
Well, The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Or if you buy I think it's like a 12-disc set if you buy all the uncut versions. Yeah.
I don't see... Like, I don't think that's a good use. You've only got, you know, we're all going to die. And I don't think that's a good use of life. I just think, you know, you could go outside, feel the rain. Don't watch 27 hours of just some little hobbity thing getting lost in a cave. I mean, you could go to Croydon and see that.
I was talking to somebody the other day, a weird thing. So like I said, like, length of film has become quite a conscious thing now when I'm picking a film. If I look at how long it is and I think, oh, it's 2 hours. I mean, that's just about acceptable. Anything more than that. And yet, I won't think about that when I'm watching six episodes of Game of Thrones in a fucking row.
Yeah.
You know, that's 6 hours sitting on a sofa. But if it's a film, I think, well, I can't do 2 hours. That's too long. It's a weird psychology going on there.
I have the same thing. I feel like if you can't tell a story in 90 minutes, it's not worth telling.
You're sounding like the bloke who used to critique us on our show, Ben. it's way too long now, mate. Come on.
I think it's more about an opt-out clause. You know what I mean? Like, if you say to, like, it's like going for a coffee with a mate and then them turning around and going, like, oh, do you want to get somewhere to eat? Yeah, all right. And then afterwards going, do you want to go to the pub? I'd happily do that. But if I, like, text you and said, right, we're going to go out on Tuesday, we're going to go for a coffee, then we're going to go for a meal, then we're going to go drinking till 10, you'd be like, whoa, Jesus. Yeah. It's like, you know, and I think it is that thing of, like, you know, it's kind of a huge expense on your time. Whereas if you can choose to opt in and out, then that's all right. Because if it's rubbish, just stop it.
I think you're right. And I think there's an age thing as well. I'm feeling old at the moment. But I went to a stag do last year. And it had about sort of four elements penned into the day. And I just thought, I'm going to pick and choose the elements. So I didn't go to the early thing, which was doing the whole golf course thing. I'm not going to do that. I'll go for some drinks, I'll go for a meal, and then the last thing on the agenda was the club. Now, I never liked clubs, even as a teenager, let alone a 42-year-old going into a club. And that was my opt-out. You know, I'd said I was going to go to the club, but the moment they started getting in the cabs to go, I was like, I think I'm going to call it a night here, lads. And I wouldn't have done that years ago. I would have gone through the whole thing. But you just get to that point and it's like, no, this is my opt-out point.
That's what I love about getting older. I love getting older and older because I think I've always been, my spirit animal has always been a grumpy old man. And like, if I had a Patronus, it would just be like a less right-wing David Dimbleby. And I kind of like, I love that as you get older, you do feel that. Because I'm exactly the same, like going to stag do's before, you'd stay to the bitter end. But now I'm like, you know what? Like, I'm not going to lie, during lockdown, I've loved it that the pubs are closing at 10. It gives me an excuse to go home. I don't want to be in there. Well, then why is the music too loud? Come on, let's stop being silly.
I've always liked an old man pub. I've always liked an old man. Like, I don't want to be somewhere where I have to shout at you to be heard. I mean, even as a kid, sort of a youngster, I didn't like that. But the weird thing is, I think also, like, the times have changed so that things, you know, a stag do used to be just a night in the pub. And now it's like a weekend in fucking Prague or something. It's like, just a few drinks is fine.
Couldn't agree more. Like, there was a time when it was like, oh, it's Jeff's stag do this weekend, you free on Saturday? Yeah. Like, yeah. But actually now it's become like, well, it's Jeff Stag doing 2023. I'm going to need to know what your blood group is, what's your passport details, what's your star sign, and when was the last time you got checked for any STIs? You know, it's just too much. And actually going to a proper, I mean, this is another conversation that I love having, a proper nice pub, and everyone has a different view of what a proper nice pub is. But I think a good pub should have like very like little light, and it should be not dingy, but it should be quite dark with a low ceiling. Absolutely no clocks. And I don't know if this is a northern thing, but in my village, whenever you used to go to the pub at around 9:30, 10:00, they always just used to come out with like a tray of sandwiches, and you just get free sandwiches.
Yeah, it doesn't happen down south.
No, in London, you'd worry they'd be spiked with something.
Or in London, they'd come out, and then at the bottom of the bill, it'd be like, yeah, it's 24 quid.
Yeah, yeah. But again, like, it was probably something that they used to do sort of back in the 70s or 60s and stuff. And that sort of nicety, that sort of, I don't know, that sort of community thing, you don't get that, you know. There's still villages where you get that sort of thing. I remember going to Cornwall years ago, there's a little pub in Cornwall, and it same thing. Like at the end of the night, there were like little fish and chip things bought out, and I don't remember being charged for it. It was just like, this is what we do.
I think that's great. It annoys me, we don't really do that sort of stuff in the UK. Like if you go on holiday, like whenever you get the bill, you get like a little shot of ouzo.
Yeah,
you get I mean, even it doesn't cost, like even if you get the bill and you've got like popcorn, that cost in pence. But in the UK, it's like, can I get some popcorn? Yeah, that'll be £5.60. You're like, you can absolutely jog on, you know.
I hate those pubs that you can't buy a bag of nuts. They've got like a little dispensing thing. Like, I just want a good old packet of Nobby's nuts. I don't want some thing that you have to turn a lever to get them.
Couldn't agree more. In my estimation, a good pub should have loads of board games. Yeah. Like, you know, and I just love that. Loads of board games, books, and a barman or bar woman, bar lady, bar person that understands that, like, you don't, like, it's like a good bar person is like a good taxi driver, in the sense that you can have a chat with them, but they also know when you don't want to chat as well.
Yes.
You don't have to go there and, you know, it's like you're strapped to a chair and then they sort of crane your eyes open and go, tell me your earliest childhood memory. Like, you know, you just sit there and read the paper and that's nice.
Frank Skinner's got a very good line on that about hairdressers. He says, when he goes to the barbers and the barber says to him, how do you like your haircut? He says, in silence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I change barbers based on the length of time it takes. So I used to go to this barber who, I mean, he was a lovely bloke, lovely guy. And I used to go there because I used to take, when my granddad, bless him, wasn't very well, I used to take him to go and get his hair cut there. And whilst we were there, I thought I'd get my hair done, because he'd been doing my granddad's hair for years. And after my granddad passed away, I kept going to this hairdresser just to sort of, because he was so nice to my granddad, sort of thing. But the last time I went, I mean, everyone knows this guy. So I don't mind if he's going to chat to people sitting in the chairs waiting, but don't stop cutting my hair. Continue the cutting process. If you're talking to me, don't stop the cutting. And I was literally in there for about an hour and a half, and I was thinking, like, a haircut for me is 20 minutes is too long. Get in and get out. As much as I love for you this sort of bonhomie, I don't need it.
Well, this is what gets me. This is why I cut my own hair, right? But this
you talk to yourself. Been anywhere nice for holiday?
Yeah, my hairdresser, he just wouldn't get to the point. You know, he's just chatting away. But during, like, so I've got my own clippers and I've been doing about it for, you know, doing it for a while. But that came back to bite me in the ass early this year, because I always sort of say that I do my own hair, lovely stuff. It's cheap. It's easy. Done. One of our mates gave us a text and sort of said, oh, mate, have you still got your hair clippers? And I said, yeah. And they went, you know, it was that time when during lockdown, everyone was like, oh, you know, everyone's got to have their hair cut and stuff. And I said, yeah, I have. You can borrow them if that's not too weird. And they went, oh, no, that would be great. And I went to pick them up a couple of days later, and I popped round and he looked exactly the same. I thought you borrowed. and then his dog came out.
No.
And the dog was a lot trimmer in hairstyle. I was like, no! So now I have to get some new ones because the freaking dog had used them.
I mean, that's a libby. That's a real libby, I reckon.
Ridiculous. But yeah, one of them things.
So I didn't bother with the whole clippers thing. I haven't had my hair cut since before last Christmas. It's just I'm totally in that lockdown again. It's that thing of working from home. Doesn't matter if I have to do a Zoom meeting thing, I just wax and gel on and just sort of whack it all down so it looks partly respectable.
Yeah, I'm completely the same. You get to a point where you're not concentrating anymore and you're just looking at yourself looking like a depressed tomato.
The thing is, right, I once grew my hair really long. I didn't get it cut for over 2 years, and when I went to go eventually and get it cut, I said to the bloke, I don't want to go really short, so just sort of cut it about halfway. And it looked great in the barbers, you know, he did it all. And I got up for work on the Monday morning and it looked fucking awful. It looked like I basically had like a bob. And I mean, it was like I looked like Claire Short, if you remember her. And and I thought, I can't go into work like this. This is just horrific. So I went up to London near work and I knew there was a barber's. And I went in. I went, and it was like someone, like a builder coming around your house looking at someone else's work. He went, who's done this? And he charged me extra to sort it out, but it was like,
oh, that's not fair.
Well, no, he did. I mean, he was a bit of an arsehole like that, but I had no choice. It was like, throw money at the problem, you know. I can't, there's no way I can go to work with it looking like this, because it was bad enough having to go out and get on the train with it looking like it did.
That is brilliant. I love stuff like that.
It's awful. Hey, look, Dave, before we say goodbye, there was another topic I wanted to talk to you about very quickly, because I heard you talking about this on another podcast, which was philosophy.
Yeah, well, I'm working on a new show at the moment, which is about like trying to take people through, handhold them through philosophy and show them that it's not fusty, it's not old, it's not silly. It is actually one of the most engaging things in the world. So when it originally started, like old Socrates' time, they used to do it in markets. They'd have a few beers and, you know, they'd chat about, you know, the world. And this was before you had physics or chemistry or biology. It came from that. And the thing that I love about philosophy is that even if you say, I don't like philosophy, even if you say, I don't want to learn philosophy, as soon as you say to the person, why? Then they are engaging in philosophy. You don't have that with anything else. You don't say, oh, I don't like ballet and I'm going to do a backflip and show you why I don't, you know. And I just think it actually is something engaging. And people think that it's all about, you know, like Wittgenstein said this or whatnot, but actually, yeah, it does happen in everyday down to earth things. And like, yeah, look, you know, pop culture, things like The Matrix. I remember when I watched that and that like screwed my head for quite a while, and Inception. But I'm trying to make it more engaging and sort of more relatable to people, because even as you can see with COVID, there's a lot of philosophy that kind of springs to mind of like, if you've had COVID, what does that even mean? And is that relevant? And yeah, I just think it's a really interesting thing.
This is what I was thinking about when I heard you talking about it, is that it's something that we all engage in, like in almost every conversation, isn't it? There's an element of philosophy involved, because you're either giving a view on the world or you're looking for a viewpoint of something. And it's like, it's all there all the time, really.
Absolutely. And especially in this like time when we're talking about deplatforming or destaging, or like, you know, what you can and what you can't say. Actually, now more than ever, it's important to sort of think about things like quite critically, because there's fake news, you've got stuff online. And actually, one of the things that I think that is brilliant about philosophy is getting you to think about what you believe, what is a true and trusted source, and actually put your own views on the line. And some of the funniest people I've ever met have been philosophers. I remember when I was at university and I was studying philosophy, and one of our lecturers, I mean, this is an honest, true story. The first year, I just find this so funny. I won't name the philosophers because they're actually quite famous and they do loads of stuff on Radio 4. But there was a group of four or five philosophers that used to go to the little pub. It was called The Style. And there is a story that we found out to be true a couple of years before we got there. They took all of their first year exam marking papers to the pub, and one ale turned into two, turned into 10. And one of the philosophers came back the next day and went, "Whoa, it was a heavy night last night, wasn't it?" The guy goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "Can I just get those exam papers? I think you took them when you left." And the guy was like, "No." And then they rang up the pub, and the pub went, "Oh yeah, you left loads of papers here, but I just thought if you've left them, so we've binned them in the lorry's bin." They're all destroyed. So the entire first year passed because they got pissed and forgot the papers they were marking. And that's
amazing.
That's incredible.
Wow. And I don't know whether this is true. I heard this story once. I can't even give you a name. You know, like when there's a story that you were told, but you can't remember the specifics. But if you know about philosophy, you might have heard this story, or this might be complete bullshit. But there was a story about this guy who was a philosopher who was diagnosed with a terminal disease. And so he thought his sort of lasting message to the world would be that he would finish his life by sitting in a pit being poured over with concrete, and he'd sit there with two fingers up at the world so that he would become like this statue. But it must be bullshit, because I've searched for this on Google and nothing has come up. But is this not a story you've ever heard?
I've never heard of that. But one that I do love is there's this quite a big hitter. You might not have heard of him. He's a guy called Jeremy Bentham. He came up with this idea called utilitarianism, which the take home message is the greatest good for the greatest number. And it kind of changed philosophy. But he was a bit of a weird old bloke. And he said that when he died, he wanted his body to be stuffed with straw and kept in University College London, and at high meals, like important meals and stately things, he'd be wheeled out. And they did that until some students got drunk. Still, I think they were cricket students, got drunk and then knocked his head off. And so they don't know where his head is. So they've still got half his body, but without the head.
Is this the one that's it's kind of displayed in a glass
cabinet?
I've seen pictures of this. They've got a false head on it now, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, false head, because it got knocked off and then it got stolen. I mean, just some of them. There's a great guy called Diogenes who used to live in a barrel and wank in the street. And he was just the weirdest bloke in the world. And there's like this quite famous story that he hated Aristotle. And Aristotle had once said, well, the quote was, "Man is nothing but an unplucked bird." So the idea is that, you know, humans and birds, the only thing that's different is the feathers. And Diogenes got a chicken, plucked it, and when Socrates was next giving a lecture, threw the bird at Socrates and go, "Behold, I give you man!" And it's so mental. There's so many of these like little grudge matches. There's like Wittgenstein and somebody else, I can't remember who else it was, but they hated each other so much that when one of them was giving a plenary talk, which is like a very big talk, the other one decided to invite the most famous philosophers in the world at the same time to have a lecture so that people wouldn't go to Wittgenstein's lecture. Like the pettiest thing you can do.
Wow. It's incredible. Well, so this hopefully will turn into a stand-up show at some point. You're working on that right now, yeah?
2022, it's looking like it's going to take that long of just like the little stories along the way. But I'm so excited because I do love philosophy.
And I suppose part of the going back to where we started in a way, the kind of writing process, whatever that means, is an element of research. So you're able to go and read up now about philosophers and find these amazing stories.
It is incredible, because that's the thing. You're absolutely right. The writing is a process. It's not something that you finish out or something that you arrive at. So it's given me, and that's one of the things that I love about comedy, and one of the things that I'm trying to teach in the comedy course, is that actually, if you can't be funny, be interesting. Just go out there, research, think about things that interest you. If you're interested in crochet, or if you're interested in people that get buried in concrete with two fingers up to the world, go and research it, because that is what makes for funny stories.
Well, Dave, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. But just before we go, we haven't mentioned you've got a book as well, Weight Expectations.
Yeah, it's rubbish.
Yeah, it's a work, though. You know, that's there's a legacy there. That's presumably in the British Library for forevermore.
Yeah, probably in the toilet. if anyone wants to buy it, it's called Weight Expectations. And, oh, God, writing a book. Don't do it. Writing a book's terrible. But, yeah, it's all about anorexia. I originally wanted to call it The Real Hunger Games because I thought that was a better title. But yeah, you can buy that now with like Waterstones. Here's another thing as well. I always say Waterstones, Amazon, or any good bookshops, and I've realized the reason that people say that is because they're trying to imply that if a bookshop doesn't sell their book,
it's not good.
It's a rubbish bookshop.
And what's the best place for people to follow your upcoming events and campaigns and things?
Well, it's horrible, but I suppose on the old Twitter, Dave Chawness, that's C-H-A-W-N-E-R, and also my website, www.davechawness.com. .co.uk.
Hello, Dave. We wish you all the best with everything you've got coming up. And well, we'll get you back on again at some point. This has been absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Cheers, Dave.
Thank you, guys.
Well, there we are. That's it for another Trev and Ben podcast. That was good fun, wasn't it?
It was really great. I absolutely loved speaking to Dave. What a treat that was.
Yeah, he's such a lovely man. One thing I didn't ask him about, but one thing I do know he does, is he's part of this thing, I can't remember what it's called. I've heard him talk about it before, where basically he will send, on Valentine's Day, postcards to people who might be lonely. It's sort of a part of a nationwide network thing.
Oh.
And just something he does. That's the sort of man Dave is.
Yes, we weren't just throwing around hyperbole at the beginning of this introduction for Dave. He truly is one of the nicest people you could ever have met or will or could meet.
Yeah, and top man. And by the way, what I was talking about, we normally do some recommendations at this point. When I heard him recently talking about philosophy, was on another podcast, which is, if you want to hear more of from Dave, it's called The Dinner Party, and he has to pick guests for his dinner party. I think I can probably let slip that Robin Williams is one of them, but the rest is just an incredible dinner party. So that's well worth a listen. Just a couple of other recommendations I've got for this week. A couple of films I've watched.
Okay.
One's a documentary called Honeyland, and it's incredible, right? So it's about this sort of not really old lady, but I guess in her 50s, and she's out in the, I don't know, in the middle of nowhere of Turkey, I think, and she's got bees and she sells honey, and it just follows her over the period of about 3 years, and it's just incredible. Like this family moving next door who really just fuck her over, and it's one of those, like we were talking earlier about films that kind of can make you weep at a certain point, and there's moments in it where you think, oh, surely a documentary about a woman who keeps some bees isn't going to make me cry, and it does.
And where can people find that?
I'm not sure. I was sent it by a mate, I think possibly a little bit on the sly, so I'm not exactly sure where you can find it.
Oh dear.
But if you can find it, it's probably on YouTube or something. It's well worth that. The other film I watched this week, which is amazing, it's on Netflix, it's in Spanish, but if you don't mind subtitles, it's well worth a watch, called The Invisible Guest.
Okay. I know The Invisible Man is on Netflix because I watched that recently, but this is The Invisible Guest.
The Invisible Guest, and it's slightly kind of, I don't know, in style almost Hitchcock-like. It's one of those films where I'm not going to give anything away, but I just didn't see the end coming. It's one of those sort of films. It's so well done that you can't work it out.
I'll give that a go.
So that's well worth a watch. And my favourite thing's back on telly, Taskmaster.
Oh, I've been watching it. They might be the most useless bunch yet, but it's very entertaining nonetheless.
It's amazing. So there we are. That's it for another week. Thank you very much for listening and downloading. Don't forget you can get in touch with us anytime about anything. We're at Trev and Ben on Twitter, and we'll catch you again next week. Till then, stay safe, stay well, and take it easy.
Bye.